Okay, at this time, I would like to introduce our speaker tonight, Glenn from Claremont. Yes. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hugs are much better. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Glenn. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 14th of 1999. That is a Monday that I checked into a residential treatment center with a trash bag with a bunch of clothes that came from dumpsters. Felt like my life was just an utter failure at that point. You know, I had a wallet with a California ID and a couple random phone numbers in it and no bank account and court cases. You know, I have a sponsor now. His name's Tom. He's sitting up here in the front, came to support me. I have a home group. It's As John Sees It on Sunday mornings. You know, all those three things were explained to be important to me when I first got here, and I tried to follow suggestions. A little bit how I got to that point. I'm a San Diego native, was born in Balboa Navy Hospital, grew up in Claremont in the very northwest corner of Claremont, where like 5 and 52 meet right above the hill there. And my street was like a long peninsula, so there was no people on either side. It was canyons, and lived down in the end by the dead end on Monongahela Street. And it was just like a Peyton's Place, you know. It was just, you know, everybody was good families, and, you know, just the kids would play in the canyon, and, you know, kindergarten walk to school, and everything was just, you know, just really, I don't know, early 1960s, late 1950s, just kind of real nice. And, you know, like I said, no dysfunctional families. But the one thing is I always felt different, not apart from. You know, I wasn't good at sports. Like this neighborhood I grew up in was all boys. And, you know, I would, you know, I remember like early age, oh, we'll even let Glenn play sometimes and stuff like that. And always just never felt a part of. You know, my family, my dad to me was a larger than life figure. My dad was in the Marine Corps in Korea in January of 53. He was out on patrol one night and a grenade went off next to him. And it was so cold and he lost so much blood, they put him on a morgue ship. My grandmother back in Springfield, Mass, actually got the people coming in your door saying, you know, your son's been killed. My mom was on the West Coast, and by the time they found her, because she was at work, they knew he wasn't dead, but they didn't know anything about it. Somebody saw him cough on a morgue ship. So my dad just has I can't go on and on about it, you know. He was wound up being paralyzed on his left side from what they called a neck wound. So he said he woke up, he couldn't read, write, couldn't talk. The only thing he could do is blink his eyes, yes or no. And he just had a remarkable story of recovery. You know, my dad, I remember asking him when I was a little kid, is like, how do you do this? And he goes, oh, it's like the itsy bitsy spider, crawls up the wall, keeps going and keeps trying. Or he'd say his Marine Corps training taught him to never give up. And, you know, I thought I would never be the man that my dad is. I could never be as, you know, as good as dad was. And, you know, he was very tough. You know, when I was a kid, be like whining and stuff, he just would say, you don't like it? Tough. And that was like end of story with dad. But, you know, but I always looked for how I was not good enough or was not a part of, or, you know, it was just a reoccurring thing growing up. You know, in junior high school and started throwing girls into the picture, and it just got worse. Not being able to talk to girls. And the summer after ninth grade, my best friend, Pete, talked me into smoking a joint in the canyon. And at first I fought that, you know, no, you know, like Mr. Guy from South Park, drugs are bad, you know, but I eventually caved, you know, and once we did that, it just like opened Pandora's box, like, this is great, you know, let's try everything. And, you know, drinking soon followed that, going to high school keg parties, you know, oh, let's, you know, hang out and meet girls or whatever. And I would just always be, you know, at the keg, just wanting more and more, never enough, you know. Constantly overshooting the mark. I can tell you that right away my parents were not down with that at all. You know, they were, my mom was 36 when I was born, so they were older, and my, you know, my dad was a World War II veteran and, you know, Korea obviously. And, you know, one of the things they tried was going to like a family counselor with me when I was, 15, maybe just 16, and talking to this guy, and I thought it was all kind of dumb. But one thing that happened, he had me by myself, and he goes, "Is there anything you'd like to share about? Any problems that you have with the family?" And I said, my one comment was, "Yeah, mom's acting weird." And it turned out that not too long after that, my dad took me aside and says, "Yeah, your mom's got this thing called Alzheimer's disease. She had early onset Alzheimer's at age 52. And they go, "Well, there's nothing," my dad told me, "there's nothing they can do about it other than test for what everything, you know, eliminate everything else it could be. And the only way they can find out for sure is do a brain autopsy after she passes away, and she's going to slowly fade away." So my mom went from being, my mom ran the family. She did all the checking, everything, you know, in the house, and, you know, took care of everything. And that slowly all changed, where my dad had to learn to do that kind of stuff. And, you know, mom just faded away as like my mom was big on manners, very polite, very, you know, good, and just kind of just like she degressed into being a child, and it was very painful. And, you know, my using and drinking not only was a way to, like, to fit in and stuff, but it was also a way to deal with the pain of what was happening and just try to, you know, avoid it. And, you know, so that set up a pattern for me. I always thought I was not as bad. My good friends I hung out with, they both dropped out of high school, and I stayed in high school, you know, and I didn't do anything in the morning before school or whatever. And, you know, I got a job. I got a job in 11th grade. I got a job at a restaurant, so I'd go to school and get off at lunchtime and go work in this restaurant. I was getting a paycheck, although I was spending it all, lived paycheck to paycheck right from that first paycheck. But, you know, I was, you know, considered, well, they're staying home getting stoned, and I'm, you know, being functional and staying in school, you know, so I'm not as bad as them. I heard Greg would drink 3 quarts of Schlitz malt liquor, and I'd drink 2 quarts, you know, so I was definitely not as bad, you know, so that was my rationalization. You know, after high school, I started dating a friend of mine, Tim's younger sister, against his advice. He told me you should just stay away from my sister. She's bad news. But, you know, it's like, oh, she likes me. And, you know, I wouldn't listen. And, you know, I actually tapered off quite a bit. But it was a very dysfunctional relationship. And it ended very badly. And, you know, my way of dealing with it was just like my mom, my friends, Pete, his parents had a rental house, and that was the party pad for everybody. And I was going to City College to the auto program, and I would go over there after work at the restaurant, you know, and just, you know, I found out if I just drank a lot and partied and stay up late, I could just kind of pass out and not have to deal with thinking or whatever. And, you know, it talks about in the book, crossing a line. I definitely crossed a line at that point where it was, went from being like the weekends and stuff to like every single night I had to get high or drunk or something, you know. And, you know, a friend of mine, Billy, had nicknames for everybody. And he called me hardcore because I would never want to stop, you know. Let's do this. Everybody crash out. No, let's go down to the beach on bikes or do something. Or, you know, I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. You know, the other white products got thrown into the mix at this point, you know, started off with the South American products. And, you know, I graduated City College, the auto program, and I got a job at a Pontiac dealership, or a couple of them. But, you know, so I was making halfway decent money. I was living at home with my dad. Mom was in the home at this point. And, you know, I was just spending all my money. I was always broke, you know, before the next time I got paid. And I remember my dad asking me about it. What are you doing with all your money and stuff? And I was like, well, I'm buying tools. And I was buying tools and stuff, but most of it was going to, you know, the weekend sprees and, you know, almost all of it. And I was actually miserable inside, but I remember I could not admit to my dad what was really going on and how I felt. And I could not. I've heard a speaker at Old Town one time talk about help is the hardest four-letter word in the English language to say. Definitely my experience. I could not ask for help. January of 1986, my mom died finally of pneumonia. And my dad called me up. I was over at my friend's house, and it was, you know, his comment was, you know, it's finally over. And I said, yeah, and things kind of got normalized, it seemed like, you know. Although, sir, not for my drinking and using. I got a lot of the product, you know, the meth got thrown into the mix then, and that took things to a whole new level. My dad was asking me about it again that summer, and had gotten some stuff from some friends of his, you know, at the VA or somebody about substance abuse, you know, counseling or some kind of a, you know, program to go talk to. And, you know, he never got around to talking to me about it. I think we talked a little bit, but November 1st, I went out to the desert with a friend of mine, Sean, on a Saturday. We left Saturday morning. I came back Sunday, and my dad had had a heart attack and died. And, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I just walked around numb for a while. I did try to sober up at this point, which to me was like cutting out the hard stuff and maybe having a beer or a joint, not hanging around with my friends who are freebasing and stuff, and just staying at home by myself. It was very miserable. I was very unhappy and, you know, just isolating by myself, you know, what they call white knuckling it. And just, you know, I wound up caving after 3 or 4 months, and it was back on. You know, wound up living at home for a while, but then me and my brother wound up selling the house. Basically, you know, I could have probably bought my brother out if I had my shit together, but I didn't at all, and I wound up with $80,000+, and I knew it was going to happen. I wound up just blowing it all, you know, just buying rent and buying drugs and partying, being extremely miserable. You know, just felt like a really failure. Just felt like my dad saw me now, he would just be just so devastated. You know, at this point, I wound up with a daughter. My girlfriend got pregnant, and you know, at one level, I thought, well, man, I've got a kind of a family now. Maybe I can get it together and, you know, do something with my life. And that ended, and the girlfriend took the daughter away, and it was just a huge mess. And I was just, you know, the money ran out. And I got DUIs and wound up losing my vehicles. And, you know, I wound up riding a bicycle around and dumpster diving, just absolutely miserable, you know. And I had to get high. I could, you know, I would crash, you know, go and go and go until I crashed. And then after I slept it off or whatever, then I, you know, once I came to, I would just be so uncomfortable in my own skin that, you know, I would have to go get high again. The summer of 1994, I got into some legal trouble, and I got a court card, and I was told to go to some meetings, and I'd heard of 12-step programs, and I thought, oh, maybe there's a solution. And I went up to a place called the Kearny Mesa Regional Recovery Center, and the first time I saw the steps, I was looking at them, and I was just going, I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't that, you know. I thought it was just completely lame. I never bothered to ask anybody about it, but my thought was it just seemed like a bunch of new age wishy-washy, just like, that's the dumbest stuff I've ever seen in my life. You know, I had a guy who recognized me from high school there and said, you should come back to the midnight meeting, it's really good, you know, and get involved. And I was like, you know, that was the time of night when I was out, usually up and about, you know, it would be midnight, would have been perfect for me. But, you know, I didn't follow through, wasn't ready. Between the summer of 94 and when I got sober in the summer of 99, it seemed like I was in jail every fall. Not a fun experience at all for me. You know, and, you know, one of the times I would try to say, well, can I go to rehab instead of jail, looking for an easier, softer way? And they said, oh, well, maybe. And then, like, when I had, I don't know, 20 days left and I was going to be released, they said, oh, you can go to this 90-day rehab now. And I go, wow, that's okay. I'm good. Huge mistake, because I just went back to doing the same stuff I was doing. The summer of 1998, I was working for a guy under the table. I was living with a friend of mine I worked with at this lady's house, and I was working on her grandson's car. Let me back up a little bit. Her daughter, my friend Sheila, she got in some trouble, and she went through crash, and I saw her come out with 90 days, and the light was on in her eyes again, and I was miserable, and I go, and I want what she has, you know, and I did not know how to get where I was at point A to where recovery was or whatever to where, you know, having light on my eyes, point B. I definitely didn't want the San Diego Police Department involved in that process, but you know, that is my story. In the fall of 98, I was working on Sheila's son's car, putting a new motor in it, and it was just after dark and out in the alley behind the house, and the cops rolled up, and I got arrested for under the influence and a possession charge, and Sheila's mom bailed me out of jail because she felt bad, I guess, because I was working on her grandson's car, and I felt a sense of responsibility to follow through what they wanted to do, because usually I was failure to appear, warrants, and all that kind of stuff, you know, because I would be just so petrified and not wanting to deal with any of my, you know, consequences. You know, so I kept following through it. You know, that between that fall and the next spring, I got three more under the influence charges. So I had like four court cases going. One of the times I was coming out of court, this lady comes up to me and goes, "Oh, there's a recovery home I'm representing called Cobar House, you know," and she kind of gave me the sales pitch and a card, and I looked into it and I thought, "Oh, it looks good, but it's $650 a month," and I go, "Where am I going to get that money? You know, I'm the guy who's, you know, getting paid on Friday and broke Saturday morning." But you know, I tried to get into crash. And they did an orientation or whatever, and you know, they said, "Okay, well, we're gonna have you call every day for 30 days and, you know, try to stay clean and sober until, you know, we got a bed for you." And I was like, if I could do that, I wouldn't even bother coming here, you know. But so anyways, I tried to do that. The day they had a bed for me, I was at my in-laws' house, you know, passed out after being up for a couple of days, and the cops raided the house and arrested me for sleeping under the influence. And so crash didn't work out for me. But what did happen is my boss, who I was working for, was a, you know, really good guy, and he paid my way into this treatment center, because you could go out and work during the week from 7 till 5 at this place. And, you know, he would give me a little bit of allowance, you know, and I got into this place called Cobar House. It was privately run. This lady named Connie and her friend Barbara started out. Connie worked at 10 Day and started a treatment center to, you know, for people coming out of 10 Day to have a place to go. And it had went from her house in Emerald Hills to where, when I got there, it was on the corner of Mead and Fairmont. It was like a 14-unit apartment building that they had for their treatment center. And, you know, I got there, it was a Monday, early Monday afternoon, and they did the intake, and they said, "Well, you're going to be down in apartment number one with Kevin." And, you know, I went down there, and I met Kevin, and if you ever seen the movie The Blind Side, so Kevin was like Sandra Bullock's son. He was a large man. He was like 6'8", 6'9", 300 pounds. Kevin grew up in East San Diego, and he did not look like a pleasant person. He looked like he could just squash you like if you were a bug, you know, if he wanted to. And he was just looking at me and staring me down. He asked me, "Are you ready to surrender to win?" And I'd never heard that before, but I knew exactly what he meant. And I was just like, "Yes, I'm just whatever. I'm ready to give up." Because they were doing that intake, and I thought, you know, I'm going to sit around a circle of people, and I'm going to be better. And it didn't seem like any kind of a solid plan to me. But you know, what I started doing is just like, they said, you know, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. And not that I'm a big talker, but it was up for me. It was about listening, you know, and trying to relate. And they said, you know, look for the similarities and not the differences. And, you know, that's what I started doing there. You know, another thing I started doing was taking suggestions. You know, they suggested, you know, well, I was in the treatment center, so I was going to be going to these meetings and groups every night. But, you know, I found that there's a big difference between sitting in the back and twiddling your thumbs or, you know, goofing off, or actually trying to listen and participate, you know, and relate. And, you know, that's what I started to do. They had a Friday night meeting called the Emerald Hills Participation Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that meeting was like, you know, for the house, but there was a lot of alumni who came back there and supported it. Very strong meeting. And they had a podium like this, not with a fancy sound system, but they had a podium. And so to that meeting, you had to go up to the podium. And I was like, to me, it's like, I don't want to go up to a podium. And they told me to, you know, do stuff, get out of your comfort zone, do stuff to get, you know, and get involved. And so I would go up and I would read how it works every Saturday, you know, every Friday, unless somebody else grabbed it. But usually I was doing it and I got to, you know, memorize that. But just as a way to get comfortable and going up there and sharing and doing something I was uncomfortable with. You know, another thing they suggested was getting a sponsor before you do your first step, you know, recovery home, you know, in autobiography thing. And, you know, so I was looking around. There's a couple guys who came Saturday morning to a meeting, and Ed and Bill, and it was a, you know, coin flip between the two of them. And, you know, they both went to Old Town Speakers, which was our one outside meeting a week we went to. And at the break, I went out and asked Bill, you know, if he would sponsor me. And he said, yeah. And I was going, okay. And he goes, oh, what do you want to do? And I go, I don't know. You tell me. And but anyways, he talked to me and he says, you know, I want you to call me every day. And that's what we started out with, you know. And so I would go down after dinner, down to our chow hall, and they had a pay phone. And I'd use the pay phone, and I called him every day. And I remember seeing Ed like a week or two later, and he says, oh, congratulations on calling Ed every day. And I go, well, you know, that's what he asked me to do. And I've talked to so many guys, you know, and talk about sponsorship, and I would ask them to call me every, you know, I want you to call me every day. And you get one phone call, maybe two, and never hear from them again. And, you know, I called every day, and, you know, he'd give me, you know, that, you know, opened up, you know, discussions to, you know, starting to work the steps. Another thing that Bill did is he started picking me up and taking me down to Old Town if the, you know, the recovery home, you know, approved of it. And since I was, you know, my sponsor, they said, yeah, that's great. So we had a meeting before the meeting, you know, and he says, oh, okay, one day we're leaving early and to go down there. And I said, okay, you know, just following suggestions. And they had the steering committee meeting, and he got me a commitment there. I've had a commitment at that meeting ever since, except for a brief period I was working up in LA, where I had to leave, you know, Saturday afternoon to go up there, up to the place I was working. But, you know, that's, you know, they show the triangle there, you know, and they have one leg of the triangle that's service. I'm very big about that. It's worked very well for me. You know, a lot of people say, you know, giving back what was so freely given for you, to you. And that was, there is very true for me today. But at the time, it was like being a part of, because I've never felt like I fit in and stuff. And I got to Old Town, and my first commitment was handing out tickets to this attractive blonde woman who was very chatty. And, you know, I felt a part of getting to talk to somebody, not like I was going to hook up with her, but just having somebody to talk to and make me feel part of the group. And, you know, then going to the steering committee meetings and, you know, getting to be on a regular basis, you know, and getting, you know, being a part of rather than apart from, you know, that was huge for me. You know, I stayed and did all this stuff they suggested at that treatment center, and I graduated after 6 months. They suggested going into sober living. I had no other place to go, but, you know, I did go to the sober living. One of the things they said when I was getting out of the treatment center, they said, you know, it's real easy to stay sober in a treatment center, but when you get out, you got to go to AA. There's really nothing else. You know, you got to do what you need to do for yourself. And, you know, they hear about 90 and 90. I went to meetings almost every day for the first couple of years. I'd go back to the treatment center I was going to and, you know, go to some of their groups because they had that offer up for me also. And it just was a way for me to stay a part of. You know, some of the things that have happened to me and blessings of recovery, when I had about 18 months or so, there was a a gal there who's about my age who was very chatty and talked to her, and we started hanging out. And I didn't really have any ideas of really like picking up on or anything. I thought it would be just nice to have a, you know, female companion just to hang out and do stuff. And she had a place down in Pacific Beach, and you know, we went down there for the day, we're hanging out, and in my defense, she started it, but I got involved with the newcomer, and you know, when they tell you to, you know, give a newcomer a year to get sober, you know, for, you know, so the newcomer can get their stuff together, I'd say, well, if you've got some time, you should stay away from them, because they can wind up drinking again and hurt your feelings. You know, that's what happened with me, and you know, I never had good relationships. But you know, instead of going through my normal stuff of, you know, let's drink or, you know, get, you know, try to avoid the whole situation, I like was on a good basis, you know, comfortable calling my sponsor. So I called my sponsor a lot. And I looked for more meetings to go to. And I was living in sober living. I still didn't have my driver's license back. I think I was going to DUI school at that point. But, you know, I found a Wednesday night meeting that was in bicycle riding distance to my where I was living in City Heights. And I thought, well, maybe I can go there and find a shoulder to cry on, you know, get some sympathy. And I went there, and it was a Fourth Dimension group, which was a pretty big, well-attended meeting at that time. And they had a different format. One night they do first weekend or first Wednesday of the month they do a step, second Wednesday a tradition, the third Wednesday they do literature other than the big book, and the fourth Wednesday they do the speaker. Well, I showed up there on the third Wednesday, and Josie was the leader, and he was sharing about emotional sobriety, and it just hit me perfectly. It's just like, oh, exactly what I needed to hear, because, you know, my emotions were all over the place. And he talked, you know, I can't really explain it all, but, you know, Bill Wilson talks about it as emotional sobriety is the next frontier of not letting your emotions run wild with you. And, you know, I got something out of that bad situation, a silver lining that was just, you know, it was like, you know, what do they call a growth opportunity? Or a effing growth opportunity. You know, I got that. You know, another thing that happened was also that brief period of hanging out with that gal in Pacific Beach. She didn't have a car either, so we were like a lot of meetings down in PB and would walk to. And so there's a meeting early mornings in Thomas Street. And, you know, we went there, and, you know, it was a good meeting, good crowd. Had couches and stuff, and I thought, oh, this is a great meeting. So after this relationship ended, a friend of mine, Chuck, you know, he goes, oh, do you want to do something on Sundays? And I go, yeah, I'm just bored out of my skull on Sundays, you know, let's go to a meeting on Sunday morning. And we tried the Alano Club in PB, and it was very big and felt impersonal. And I go, you know, I know there's this other meeting, they have couches and it's a small meeting and stuff. And so we showed up there on a Sunday morning. It was the name of the meeting, still on Sunday Kind of Love. And I found a group of people there that was absolutely amazing. That became my home group for years. You know, there was the women would go out for coffee and stuff, and the men would go out for breakfast. And I started going out to breakfast with the men there. And there was two guys, Ron and John B., another John B., seems to be a very famous name in AA. But, you know, they basically took me under their wing and helped me out in so many ways. And, you know, just gave me, you know, good orderly direction. You know, what else? And it was just so much help for me, you know, finding, you know, that kind of a God, that kind of a spirit. There was a saying when I got into treatment, it's like water seeks its own level. So for me, what that looks like is before I got sober, when I was hanging out with a bunch of people who were using and this and that, and people were going to prison, and I had a lot of very low companions before I got sober, that's where I was. But after I got sober, when I got around people who were like doing stuff to improve their lives and get better, it allowed me to rise up and get better too. You know, it just, when I first got here, my problems just seemed absolutely overwhelming. No bank account, crappy job, you know, no place to live, no money, no this, no that. And they told me, you know, put your sobriety first and everything else will start falling into line. What that looked like for me is without being sober, I could not get a better job. Without being sober, I could not get off formal probation. You know, I couldn't get a bank account. I couldn't get my driver's license back, any of that stuff. And, you know, I can tell you that most of the people I knew who were on formal probation, that was their next step was going to prison. And, you know, I knew people who tried all kinds of stuff. Oh, you just drink bleach or this and that, you know. And I found out, well, if you just stay clean and sober, you can test any time you want, and it's no big deal. It's easy, you know. And, you know, so that, you know, I got off probation. I tell you the story about one time my daughters were living near me when I first got into that sober living in City Heights. And I'd go pick the girls up every Saturday, and we'd take the bus down to the movies or somewhere. And, you know, it was a great experience. The younger of my two girls, who was so funny when she's little, she'd always go, "You got money?" And I was always broke before I got sober. But after I got sober, it was just like, you know, okay, here's you know, like sugar daddy to buy all kinds of stuff. And I finally had to, you know, we'd go, part of our routine would be on the way home, we'd stop at the little 99-cent store or whatever like that. And they could get, you know, two things, you know. And Jackine would always be pushing it. "Can I get three things?" I go, "No, just two." And, you know, I got to be more of a stand-up dad because I felt like an utter failure as a father before I got here. And, you know, I remember thinking, how am I ever going to teach my girls to drive when they get older or any of that kind of stuff? And, you know, when they both got 16, I was able to buy them cars. And my older daughter went up to UC Santa Cruz, and I was able to support her and drive back and forth to there and constantly repair her car and do that kind of dad stuff. And, you know, it was a lot of it was a pain in the ass, but it felt good to be able to do that stuff. One of the times when we were going out, my older daughter was like kind of upset, and I was going, "What's wrong?" She goes, "Mom says we're moving again." And her mom is one of us and has mental health issues, and so they were moving all the time. They moved up to San Marcos, and I thought, oh great, I'm never going to see my daughter again. There was a time when they moved away from me before I got sober, when I could never make it from Claremont over to City Heights. And you know, it killed me not to see my daughter, but I couldn't like figure out how to do it, you know. And you know, I just, you know, just feel miserable about it rather than, you know, like figure out, oh, it's not really hard to get there. But you know, when that happened, I looked at, okay, how do I get into second conviction drunk driver school, and how do I take a bus up to San Marcos? So I got involved with the DUI school, and I took a bus to San Marcos every Saturday for, I don't know, 2 years till I got my driver's license and I got a vehicle. It was four buses each way, about 3 hours each way, and I just bring a book and do it. And I can tell you that being able to do stuff like that, even though it was kind of sucky to have to take a bus for such a long distance, it felt good to be able to do that stuff. There was a lady that I remember, first time I heard it at Sunday Kind of Love, who says, "If you want self-esteem, do esteemable things." That's been another gift of sobriety, is being able to do that stuff, you know. And I made it through that 18-month drunk driver program, got my license back, saved up money. There was a little blue Toyota truck that was like two houses down from the sober living that I always kind of saw. And that's a cool, nice looking truck. It's got nice rims on it. And after I had this money saved up, all of a sudden it was for sale, and now it became my truck. Some of the other stuff that's happened to me. That time I got arrested for sleeping under the influence. I had a court appearance the second day I was in treatment, and I went down there and they said, "Oh, we're not filing charges. What's your address now?" And I had no idea what the address at the place was I was at. And I gave one of my old addresses, you know, and didn't think nothing of it. So I was working up in LA about a year or so later, and I had to get a waiver from the probation department to go up there. And one time I called the lady up and to get it renewed or whatever. And she goes, "Oh, you have a court case." I'm going, "Court case for what?" You know, she goes, "Oh, failure to appear or something like that." And so they refiled that case, and they, you know, they couldn't find me. So it was a failure to appear or whatever. You know, so this whole time I'd been going to lots of meetings. I had meeting slips that were like, you know, constantly filled out, all legit too. And I was able to get a letter of recommendation from the recovery house I went to. I was able to get a letter of recommendation from the sober living I was at. And I had to go down there and turn myself in. I was sitting there, and finally the public defender calls me back, and he goes, okay, well, we're going to give you 90 days and this and that. And I was like, wait, you don't understand here. And had to tell him my situation, and you know, like he was just going to roll over and just, okay, there you go, 90 days. And went in there, and he started to say something, and the district attorney got a wind of it. And they said, oh, we want to just let this guy go. The district attorney did. The district attorney made some phone calls and called up and says, oh, he's doing the right thing. Let him go. And that has been another, you know, thing of sobriety for me. It's like you do the right stuff, you know, and you don't get a lot better results. Although it's not easy. It scared the shit out of me having to go down to the courthouse and turn myself in and, you know, do all that with a failure to appear and, you know, under the influence charge, because I knew what those were all about from past experiences. But, you know, they let me go and they said, just keep on doing the right thing. That was great. You know, it's slowly putting my life back together. You know, I heard a speaker at Old Town one time say, you know, sobriety is like playing a sad country western record backwards. You get your dog back, you get your truck back, you get your gal back. That is definitely by experience. You know, things have kept coming, you know, getting back, you know, and my daughter got me a great dog after she got back from college and was living with me for a while. And, you know, I got a better truck now. And so I was at Old Town Speakers listening to a speaker one time, and I can't remember who it was, but I remember him talking about, he was about 56, and he goes, yeah, I met this great gal, and, you know, I never thought this was happy and it happened, you know, and I'm happier than I'd ever be. And so I was in my mid-40s at that point. I'm going, that's more years than I can count on my fingers, you know. But I remember that. He goes, don't give up hope. Just, you know, never give up hope. So my mentor, wound up being my grand sponsor, John B., got me involved in San Diego Spring Roundup. And so I got there, and I had done the 5K, 10K committee. And my now wife got involved with the Roundup, and our mutual friend Kirk Waterman had told Robin, says, oh, you should be on the 5K, 10K committee. And my co-chair had decided that she didn't want to step up to the chair position. So Robin got thrown into the mix, not knowing what to do. And Kirk says, talk to Glenn, because he did it last year, and he'll tell you everything you need to do. And so we started talking, being of service at the Spring Roundup. And a year later, I asked her out, and it just went like that. I was 56 when I met her. And, you know, I'm happier I've ever been in my life. You know, my grand sponsor, John V., when we'd go out to eat, he would talk about his relationship with Mona, and he goes, we never have arguments where it devolves into, you know, name-calling or yelling or screaming, and that's just, oh, that just sounds like a dream, you know. I was in so many dysfunctional relationships that were just awful, you know. And, you know, me and Robin had, gonna be 7 years this June, have never had any kind of an argument where we've had, you know, raised voices or name calling or anything like that. You know, we've had our disagreements and stuff, but you know, you talk it out and, you know, have healthier ways of dealing with it. And to me, that's another gift of AA, is, you know, like the emotional sobriety, getting better at stuff. You know, I've been able to put money in my bank. I've, you know, they asked me when I was first in treatment, is like, well, what was a goal you'd like to set, you know? And I was like, I don't know, not live paycheck to paycheck. And you know, I was able to do that, although lately I've been helping my daughter because she was between jobs and a boyfriend who had a gambling habit, it turns out, and I've had to spend a lot of money to try to keep her financially afloat so she doesn't get evicted. But you know, that's, you know, being able to do that kind of stuff is a blessing on one hand, although I'm not really happy with her choice in boyfriends. But, you know, so many gifts of sobriety, you know, it's like there's a saying I remember hearing, you know, is like, you don't know what you don't know. And for me, it was like, before I got sober, I didn't know how much better my life could be after getting sober and working the steps and doing this stuff. If I had, I would have done it a lot sooner. But, you know, I got here when I got here, and, you know, I enjoy my life today. You know, I've learned so much from people around here who've shared their experience. I've also learned a lot from seeing people who don't do this stuff. I can tell you that when I first got here, I did not think I had an alcohol problem. Definitely had a methamphetamine problem. But my first sponsor, Bill, was asking me at Old Town, why haven't you taken a token? And I said, well, they have part of their format saying something about if your problems are other than alcohol, you think you should go somewhere else. And he goes, well, did you ever have a problem controlling and enjoying your drinking when you drank? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, there you go. Take a token. And I've been involved with AA, you know, pretty much ever since. One thing I've noticed from a lot of people, they'll like, oh, well, I can just have one beer, you know, and they'll have a beer, and that just opens Pandora's box to all the other stuff. And, you know, because smoking meth doesn't sound like a good idea to me anymore. But there have been times like, oh, maybe a beer would be cool, you know, have a drink. And I don't want to go there. I've seen too many people that have gone down that road. I enjoy my sobriety today. You know, I think that's about it for now. I have more stories I could probably tell, but I think this is a good place to stop. But anyways, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.